Osho, Tao, the Pathless Path, Volume 1. Talks on extracts from the Lita Zoo, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 4.
The first question. What is not illusion? All is illusion except the witness. All is dream except the witness. Only the knower is true, is real. Whatsoever you see is illusory. The seer is not illusory. In the night you see one type of dreams, in the day you see another type of dreams. In the night the dreams of the day are forgotten, in the day the dreams of the night are forgotten. Sometimes you dream with open eyes and sometimes you dream with closed eyes. But one thing remains eternally there, never changing, and that is your consciousness. In the night you see the dreams, in the day you see things, the world. Everything changes, night into day, day into night, dreams into thoughts, thoughts into dreams. Only one thing remains eternally there, your witnessing. That which is eternal is true. That which is changing is illusory. Remember, by illusion I don't mean that it is not. By illusion I only mean that it is not eternally true. And what is the meaning of being something temporarily true? Only for the moment. Before the moment it was untrue. After the moment, it again becomes untrue. That's why in the East, we have not been chasing life. Before birth, it was not there. After death, it will not be there again. So this momentary phenomenon is not of much value. There is no need to get obsessed by it. One can pass through it unconcerned, untouched by it. The emphasis of the West is on that which is seen, and the emphasis of the East is on that which is the seer. Either you focus on the object, or you focus on yourself. When you focus on the object, your approach is scientific, objective. When you focus on the subject, your approach is religious. This subject is eternally true. The Bible says, in the beginning there was the Word. The East cannot say that. The East says, in the beginning there was the witness. In the middle there is the witness. In the end there is the witness. One thing remains eternally, the substratum of all. Even if the Word was there in the beginning, somebody must have heard it, otherwise it cannot be. So the one who heard it precedes the Word. The Word cannot be in the beginning. The seer, the witness. Just go on looking more and more for the witness, and go on more and more getting involved into the witness. And one day, the gestalt changes. Your focus goes through a transformation. For example, right now you are listening to me. You can listen in two ways, because each thing can be done in two ways, Eastern and Western. You are listening to me, your emphasis can be on what I am saying, on the speaker. Then it is a Western approach. The Eastern approach is your emphasis is on the listener, the watcher, the observer, the witness. You are not too much concerned with what is being said or what is being heard, but who is this witness who is hearing this? You are seeing me. Who is this seer who is seeing? That transformation, that change of gestalt will bring you to the world of non-illusion. Otherwise, everything is illusory. I understand your question. You mean by it that there must be something real in the outside world and something unreal. No. The outside is unreal. It is not that something is real and something is unreal. The outside is unreal. And the inside is real. With the outside, mind grows. With the inside, meditation. To work with the outside, your mind becomes more and more efficient. In the West, the mind has become tremendously clever. When you start looking at the inside, at the looker, then meditation grows. Then you don't become a great thinker or a great philosopher, but you experience truth. You become a great mystic. You become a Buddha, a Lihitazu, a Jesus. But the whole emphasis, always remember, is on the mirror that reflects. Don't become too much attached with that which is reflected. You look in the mirror. Your image looks so real, but it is unreal. Don't get too much obsessed with the image. The images are unreal in the mirror, and the person who is standing before the mirror is also unreal. Only one thing is real: the consciousness that knows I am standing before the mirror, the consciousness that knows that the mirror is reflecting the one who is standing. That transcendental consciousness is reality, and through that descends the benediction, Satchidananda. Through that, one becomes true, conscious and blissful. Why we call the world illusory? Let me remind you again, by illusory we don't mean unreal. We mean temporarily real, only for the time being real. Why we call the outer world unreal? Because it brings only misery. And it gives you only projections, ambitions, desires. It never allows you to be really happy, authentically happy. It gives you hope, but never fulfills it. It leads you on many journeys, but the goal never arrives. Hence, it is called Maya, illusion. It deceives you. It is a mirage. It appears it is there, but when you reach there, you don't find anything. And by the time you reach there, your desires are being projected further ahead. It is like the horizon. You go towards it, it goes on receding back. You never arrive. You cannot arrive. By its very nature, it is not possible. It only appears, it is not there. Just the opposite is the case when you enter your inner world of consciousness. The closer you come, the more real it becomes. The closer you come, more blissful, more cheerful, more joyful you become. The closer you come, the more authentic and true you become. And the moment you stand at the very center, you are truth itself. In that moment, the Upanishadic seer declared, I am God, I am Brahma, Aham Brahmasmi. In that moment of inner centering, Al-Hallaz Mansur declared, Anal Haq, I am the truth. In that moment, Jesus says, I and my God are not two, but one. If you move towards the object, you are moving away from you. And farther away you go from yourself, farther away you are going from truth, because truth is centered in you. You ask, what is not illusion? I would like to say, except you, everything is illusion. But I should hurry to say you that when I say you, I don't mean the you that you know. I mean the you that is yet undiscovered by you. The you that you know belongs to the outside world. It is as much unreal as the outside world. The you that you know is nothing but accumulation of all the illusions, all the dreams and desires. The you I am talking about has nothing to do with you as such. It is the eternal you, the eternal Tao. It is not yours, it is not mine, it is nobody else. It is everybody's. It is the very center of all. When your I drops, then the real I arises. When your self disappears, the real self arrives. People come to me and they say, we feel very difficult to surrender, because surrendering means we will be losing ourselves. They are true, and they are not really true. They are true because their self, the self that they have known up to now, is going to be dropped. But they are not really true, because once this false self is dropped, the real self arises. It is there. It is hidden behind the cloud of the false self. You, as you really are in your center, is the reality. Everything else is illusory. To know this reality, one has to come to a moment of total inactivity. Because whenever you are acting, you are outside yourself. That's why Lihtazu, Chuangtazu, Laostazu emphasize too much passivity. When you are active, you are relating with the outside world. What is activity? Activity means relating with the outside. When you are passive, you are not relating at all. You are simply there, unrelated. There is no bridge between you and the outside. All bridges have disappeared. In this total silence, in this total unrelatedness, you become aware who you are. Otherwise, the activity keeps you so much occupied. There is no space for the self to assert, to manifest. It goes on waiting. It goes on waiting, and you go on remaining occupied with trivia, with mundane things. One has to learn to do nothing. I have heard the bum appeared at the doctor's office, doubled up with pain. After a careful examination, the physician told the man, he would have to give up wine, women and song. But doctor, the man protested, not knowing what that had to do with his ailment, I can't bend down. Ah, yes, said the doc, you will have to give up smoking too. I object, said the bum. Why? Asked the doctor, I feel like a fool standing around doing nothing. Doing nothing, one feels as if one is a fool. One has to do something. If you cannot do anything, at least smoke. People start smoking whenever they don't have anything to do. Smoking is a complimentary thing. Whenever you don't have anything to do, at least you can smoke. You feel occupied. People feel foolish if they have nothing to do. Have you not observed this phenomenon in yourself? If you are just sitting, you start feeling restless. You have to do something. If somebody comes, you will pretend to do. You will start reading the same newspaper you have read already. Just to show that somebody has come, so you take the newspaper in your hand. So he knows that you are doing something. Otherwise, he will think you are a fool, what you are doing. A man has to do something always and continuously. People pretend. They cannot just be. It is not allowed. In the West, you have the saying that the empty mind is the devil's workshop. If somebody is not doing anything, that is dangerous. In fact, the active mind is the devil's workshop. The empty mind has never done anything wrong to anybody. Hitler is not an empty mind. Buddha is an empty mind. Genghis Khan is not an empty mind. Chuang Tzu is. All nonsense that has happened down the centuries has been done by the active mind. The inactive mind has not done any wrong. Because the active mind is not interested in, the inactive mind is not interested in doing at all. So who bothers? You cannot persuade an inactive mind to become an Adolf Hitler. He will laugh at the ridiculousness of it. Why, he will say? For what? Alexander, while coming to India, met Diogenes. He was an inactive mind. He was lying on the bank of a river, resting, taking a sun bath, naked. Alexander was very much impressed. The peace that surrounded this naked man, the silence, the beauty of this man, the grandeur, the grace, the natural simplicity, the spontaneity. Alexander felt jealous. It is said Alexander has never felt jealous with anybody else because he had more than anybody else. Why he should feel jealous? But with this naked man, he felt jealous. He has something that Alexander can never even dream about. And he said to Diogenes, if next time I am sent back to the world, I will say to God, I will pray that now make me, Diogenes, don't make me an Alexander again. And Diogenes laughed. He said, why wait that much? You can become Diogenes right now. Who is preventing you? You can rest here and take the sun bath as I am taking. The point was clear as it can be. Alexander felt ashamed and he said, yes, one day I also hope. When I have conquered the whole world, then I will also rest and enjoy like you. But Diogenes says, I don't understand. Why? If I can enjoy without conquering the world, why you cannot enjoy right now? That which can happen right now, why you are postponing? And this bank of the river is big enough for many people. You will not be encroaching my space. It is big enough. Nobody ever comes here. It is said Alexander came very sad after he met Diogenes, and he remained sad for many days, and he talked again and again about Diogenes. The impact was tremendous. A passive, inactive, empty mind has a beauty, and only in the inactive mind one comes to know what is true. The activity creates the illusion. The activity creates ripples around you, and you cannot see that which is. Inactivity, all ripples gone, the lake silent, the mind has no thoughts, everything disappeared, the smoke gone, and the flame burns bright. When the consciousness burns so bright that there is no smoke and the flame is pure, then you know what is real. The way to reality is through inaction, passivity, receptivity. The way to the real is through feminine receptivity. The way to the unreal is through male aggressive activity. The second question, why don't I have a question? It is from Vani. You are fortunate, Vani. Now don't bring the question from the back door. Don't become worried about it. Why don't I have a question? You are fortunate. You are blessed. Because not to have a question means you are getting ready to have the answer. A person who is too much full of questions will never receive the answer. Remember, ordinarily people think that how you are going to get the answer if you don't ask. It is wrong. You get the answer only when there is no question. A non-questioning mind arrives. A questioning mind never arrives. If you ask, yes, some answer will be given to you, but it will never be received. When a mind is too much obsessed with questions, even if this mind receives an answer, he creates more questions out of this answer and nothing else. You ask one question, I will answer, and out of my answer you will find 10 questions arising in you. Your questioning mind will go on creating questions. A non-questioning mind is needed to receive the answer. The answer is here. The answer has always been there. But because you are asking so many questions, you cannot receive it. It used to happen whenever a person will come to Buddha and will ask some questions, he will say, wait for 1 year. Be silent for 1 year. Drop all thinking. And after 1 year, you ask, I will answer. A great scholar came. And he asked many questions, and Buddha listened, and then he said, I will answer, but you have to wait 1 year. That's my condition, and my promise too. After 1 year, I will answer. The man said, okay. But another disciple of Buddha who was sitting by the side of the tree started laughing loudly. The questioner felt a little embarrassed, and he asked, what is the matter? Why he is laughing? Buddha said, you ask him. And the man asked him, "Why you are laughing?" He said, "Buddha is deceptive. He deceived me. And now I am laughing because he is deceiving you too. He told me the same thing. Wait 1 year silently. Drop your thinking. All thoughts, let them disappear and then ask. But when thoughts disappear, how you are supposed to ask? Now no question is left. So I am laughing. He is deceiving you again. If you really want to ask, ask now. Otherwise, you will never ask." But Buddha said, "That is my condition. And if you ask after 1 year, I will answer. If you don't ask, then I am not responsible." 1 year passed, and Buddha asked that man, "Now what do you say? Have you some questions left?" And the man started laughing, and he said, "Now I understand why that disciple was laughing on that day. Questions have disappeared. Good Vani, if no question arises, that's how it should be. Don't feel uneasy about it." I understand one feels uneasy. One feels a little abnormal when everybody is asking the question and you are not asking the question. One feels, what is wrong with you? When everybody is going to the doctor, one starts thinking to go. Otherwise, people will think something is wrong. Whatsoever is being done by everybody, one imitates. Don't try to create a question which is not there. Rest into this non-questioning attitude. And don't think that your quest is not intense. The mind will say, "No question is arising because there is no quest." No. If there is real authentic quest, questions disappear. Only thirst remains. And that's a totally different state of mind. No question is formulated. Only quest. An unverbalized intensity. A passion. One wants to know, but there are no questions. Because how can you ask the real question? The real question is going to be so profound, it cannot be put into words. All that can be put into words will be trivial, will be ordinary, will not be of much depth. Words are on the surface. There is a state of mind when there is no question, but the quest is there, like heartbeat. You feel it, but you cannot say what it is. Then you have become the question. No question is there, your whole being has become a question, a quest, a thirst, a hunger. And in that moment, when your whole being is a quest, without any verbal questions, the answer comes. In fact, the answer is there in that intensity. You become aware of it. But I am not saying that you should not ask questions. If it comes, ask it. I am not saying that you should start fighting with questions. If it is not coming, good. No need to produce it. No need to make any effort to formulate it. If it is coming, good. Let it be relieved. Let it be asked. Don't start fighting. The mind is very tempted always to do the wrong thing. For example, I am saying to Vani that if the question is not coming, no need to ask. Good. But I am not saying to others who are asking questions and the questions are arising, If they are arising and you don't ask them, they will become more and more stronger. An unasked question, if it is there, will start haunting you, will drive you crazy. That is not the way to get rid of it. Go on asking. Watch. Witness that the question arises, you ask it, I answer. Then watch your mind, what your mind is doing. Whether it is receiving the answer or is creating new questions. Watch it. And by and by you will become aware that this seems to be a ridiculous situation. You ask a question, answer is given, 10 questions arise. You will ask 10 questions, 10 answers will be given, 100 questions will arise, so on and so forth. This will be ad infinitum. Just watch the ridiculousness of it, the hopelessness of it. And out of that experience of hopelessness, out of that understanding that this is not going to be the way, one day suddenly you will feel the question is not arising. I am not saying fight with the questions. I am saying just understand the questioning pattern of your mind. Then out of that understanding, questions burn and disappear. One day, suddenly you will be in the same position as Vani is. Suddenly you will see there is no question, and a question will arise. Why don't I have a question? Don't ask that question, because that is not a question at all. Then you are turning a blessing into a curse. Don't bring from the back door. I have heard Mulla Nasruddin had one of the finest apple orchards in the state. And come fall, regular as clockwork, the kids from the neighborhood would sneak in to purloin apples, regularly too. Nasruddin would come charging angrily out of his house, waving a shotgun and threatening the fleeing youths with everything he could think of. After watching one of these vain pursuits, a neighbor said to Mulla Nasruddin, "Dang, if I can understand you, Nasruddin, you are normally a calm and generous man, and you have got 10 times as many apples ripening in that garden as you can possibly use. Why don't you just let the kids have some?" "Heck," laughed Nasruddin, "I want them to have the apples, but I was a boy once myself, and if I did not holler and chase them, they would never come back." And thoughts are like children, so are questions. If you chase them, they will come back. If you don't chase them, they will not come back. What is the point? So don't take a shotgun and chase your questions. Otherwise they will come, and they will come in crowds, and they will bring others too. And you will go crazy. Never chase thoughts. Just try to see the whole process, how the mind functions. Once you know how the mind functions, in that very knowing, you have transcended. Yes, one day it happens. You are there with a deep passion to know, and there is no question. Then your whole consciousness has become a quest. And in that very intensity, something evaporates, something changes. Out of that very intensity, just as at the 100 degree heat, the water evaporates. In that 100 degree quest, when you are totally in it, something radically changes. That change will bring you to the answer. No question ever brings the answers. Only a non-questioning quest. The third question. Since your lecture yesterday, I worry that what I felt was acceptance of a situation may merely be consolation. How can I know when I have accepted something or when I have only consoled or distracted myself from the pain? It is simple. Consolation is out of thinking, explanations, theories. Acceptance is out of understanding. When you explain yourself, you console. When you understand, then there is acceptance. Consolation has to be brought in, acceptance comes. Acceptance is a happening. Consolation is a doing. You are miserable. Then you seek some theory, how to explain it. Past life, karmas. Somewhere you try to find a shelter. Or maybe God is putting you in misery so that you can grow. It is a challenge to grow, a consolation. Or it is the nature of life. You philosophize. You say everybody is in misery and I cannot be the exception. Buddha says whole life is misery. So it is. One has to accept it. What else can you do? One has to accept it, then it is consolation. Then you try hard to create a buffer around yourself. Acceptance is out of understanding. It has no explanation. The misery is there. You look into the misery. And you don't bring any theory. And you don't bring any explanation. You simply look into the fact of misery, and looking into the fact of misery, suddenly you find there is arising an acceptance. And if somebody asks why, you will not be able to answer because there is no why. You will not be able to show the cause. You will simply say it has happened. Acceptance is like love. All that is really beautiful is always like love. When you fall in love with a woman or a man and somebody asks why, can you really answer it? You try sometimes, but all your answers are absurd. You say because the woman is beautiful, but there are millions of people and they have not fallen in love with that woman. If she was beautiful, she would not be available to you. Somebody else must have grabbed before you. But nobody else thinks she is beautiful. So in fact, you are putting things upside down. You say, I have fallen in love because she is beautiful. The real thing is just the opposite. She looks beautiful because you have fallen in love. One day when love will disappear, the same woman will not look beautiful to you. She may even start looking ugly and horrible. Right now you cannot leave her for a single moment. One day when love has disappeared, you will not be able to tolerate her presence for a single moment. And you cannot do anything about love. When it comes, it comes. When it goes, it goes. It is like a breeze. It comes and it is gone. Acceptance is like love. It is a happening. When you are true, authentically with the reality of the moment, you don't go to the past to find an explanation. You don't go to the future to find an explanation. You simply look into the fact. You don't ask Buddha, you don't ask Krishna, you don't ask Litazu. You don't ask anybody. You simply look into the facticity of the misery. You simply live the pain. You simply go into it. Alone, holding nobody's hand. Buddha, Krishna, Christ, nobody's hand. You simply go into it. Because all those hands will become consolations. Because all those people will become explanations. You will say, Jesus says this. Buddha says this. That's why I have to accept. But your acceptance is pseudo. It has not arisen out of your own experience. Go into the pain of a situation, single-handed, alone. Face the situation as it is, with no mind to explain it away. Just look into it without any thought interfering, and then there will be acceptance. It will not be a consolation. There will be great contentment. Suddenly you will see you can accept, but there is no cause to it. Consolation has a cause to it. Consolation is a false coin. It deceives you. It pretends to be the real thing. It is not the real thing. And I would like to tell to the questioner that it is very much possible that whatsoever he was thinking to be acceptance must have been consolation. Because if it was acceptance, no doubt will arise. The certainty is self-evident. If it was acceptance, no confusion is possible. No worry will arise. It must have been consolation. Because the consolation is just on the surface. It never goes deep. And anything can shake it and shatter it. Drop all consolations. They are not worth. They are just wasting time. It is better to suffer than to be consoled. It is better to be in pain than to be in consolation. Because through pain, there is a possibility to reach to the real acceptance. Through consolation, there is no possibility. You have taken a wrong turn. Through consolation, you never reach to the reality. You have fallen a victim of a dream. Now, you will have to live in your consolation and you will start being afraid of reality. Because everything of the real will be a shattering thing for your consolation. You will avoid. You will not see directly. You will escape from facts. And if somebody brings you to the facts, you will start feeling very restless. You will start perspiring. You will feel nervous. Because you will know now everything is going to be settled. Consolation is a belief. A created thing. Cannot be of much value. You have created it. It cannot be bigger than you. It is bound to be smaller than you. Acceptance is bigger than you. It happens. When acceptance happens, it happens when you don't cling to any consolation. So put all the consolations aside. It is hard. Tao is so pure that in the beginning it is very hard. And you want to play with toys. And Tao never gives any toys. It has no belief systems to supply. It simply forces you to encounter the reality, whatsoever it is. Painful, then let it be painful. What can be done? Whatsoever is, is. It has to be looked into. But through that very encounter arises a tremendously new consciousness. A new being is born. So please put aside all your consolations, all your theories and beliefs. They are hindering your path. Once you are nude, with no belief systems around you, once you are unburdened, then immediately a great trust happens. Trust in life. Trust in existence. And trust is not a belief. Trust is a total conversion. It is a new birth. It is a resurrection. So be very alert. It is very easy to fall into the trap of consolations because they are cheap. You can purchase them anywhere. Every temple, every church, every organized religion is supplying them. And people go to churches just for that, to find consolations. Your sleep is disturbed, you need a lullaby. You go to the church and the priest supplies you the lullaby. He sings the song. He repeats the song again and again. You become solaced. It is like a tranquilizer. It gives you a good sleep. Gurdjieff used to say to his disciples that I am doing only two things in your life. One, if you really have come to me, then you will never be able to sleep again. I will disturb your sleep permanently. And second, that if you listen to me, your life will be hard, arduous. But one thing I can promise, you will not die a dirty death. You will not die like a dog. Both are tremendously significant. If your sleep is disturbed only, then you will not die like a dog. Dog means the animal state, fast asleep, unconscious. You can die consciously, then you die a beautiful death. Because then you know, even while dying, you know you are not dying. That is the beauty of it. Right now, even alive, you don't know you are alive. Even living, there is no life. You are simply dragging. It is phony. And a man who has encountered life and its facts and gone through its pleasure and pain, dark nights and beautiful days, and watched everything and has become a profound observer, will die in a totally different way. He will die alert, aware. I was reading just few days before the memoirs of the doctor who attended Gurdjieff when he died. And the doctor says, I have attended so many people while dying, but this death was tremendously exceptional. And the doctor says, I cannot think anybody has ever died like that. The moment he was dying, he opened his eyes, sat in his bed, supported by many pillows, asked for his hat, put his hat on, a very beautiful red hat, took his cigar in one hand, in another hand a cup of coffee, he smoked, sipped the coffee, and the doctor is seeing, and the disciples are crying and weeping. And the doctor knows within seconds he is going to disappear. And his legs have become numb, and they have gathered too much water, and the water has to be removed. And the doctor knows, even he may not be able to remove the water completely. Before he is removed, the water is removed, Gurdjieff will be gone. And he asks Gurdjieff, because it seems unnecessary giving him pain. Now he is going to die, death is certain. And he asks Gurdjieff, what should I do? And Gurdjieff says, if you are tired, then I have been waiting for so many years for death, I can wait a little longer. You can rest a little and then you can do. I have been waiting so long, I can wait a little longer. There is no problem. You can have a little rest, 2-3 hours, if you are too much tired, because you have not been asleep the whole night. If you are not tired, you do your work. The doctor starts taking water out of his legs, crying, because he is also a disciple too. And Gurdjieff is there, and sipping his coffee and smoking his cigar, and talking and joking. All life disappeared from the body, but his face is aflame. His eyes are so radiant. And the last moment he says, anybody has any question? Because now I'm leaving. He used to say to his disciples, one can die very consciously. And he died very consciously. When he was removed to the hospital just 24 hours before, because he insisted that he will not go to the hospital. And he asked the doctor, what do you think? Can the hospital save me? If I cannot save, then who can save me? But 24 hours before, this doctor started crying. So he said, okay, if you are crying, I'm coming. So the doctor ran outside to phone for the ambulance. And when the ambulance came, he went into the room and Gurdjieff has disappeared. He could not believe that where he has gone, because he cannot move. He was standing on the road near the ambulance. He came in and he said, where is the doctor? And the ambulance has come. And he was walking. And the doctor could not believe it was impossible. He was not in a situation. Other doctors came to consult and nobody could believe that he can walk. But he walked to the ambulance. Not only that, he came in again to inquire, where is the doctor? 2 weeks before, suddenly, and he was ill, very ill. One evening, he asked his disciples, bring my car, I would like to drive. 2 weeks before, and they said that the doctor says, you should not move out of the bed. He said, forget all about doctors. Bring my car. And he drove the car and went to a certain Russian church and there sat for 1 hour with closed eyes under a tree. Only later on people could know that was the place where he was buried after 2 weeks. He had gone there 2 weeks before to see the place. And exactly he sat on the place where he was to be buried after 2 weeks. And then they all understood. Death was so clear to him. when it is going to happen, where he is going to be buried. And that was the church he had never gone in his whole life. It was not that he used to visit. He had never gone. That was the first and the last time alive. Next time he was dead. Bennett reports that when he reached 24 hours late. Gurdjieff had died. In the middle of the night he reached, he rushed to the church where his body was lying. He went into the room. There was nobody. He sat silently and he became afraid. He started trembling because he could feel as if Gurdjieff is still alive. And he is a scientist, a mathematician, and he cannot be deceived. He is not a devotee. He is not emotional, sentimental, not the feeling type at all. So he went close by to feel what is the matter. He completely became silent to listen. He could feel as if somebody is breathing. He went all around the room. Closer, whenever he will come closer to the body, he will feel the breathing more clearly. Whenever he will go further away, the breathing will not be heard so clearly. And the man is dead. But he had a feeling that he is still hovering around, as if the body is alive, as if his presence is there. It is possible. A man who dies totally alert can do many things. A man who dies in awareness, in fact, never dies. He has come to recognize the deathless in him. Drop consolations, beliefs, become more and more alert. Drop your sleep and drop your lullabies. That's the only way. Tao is simple and yet arduous. Simple because Tao cannot be arduous. Arduous because you are very complex and you cannot be simple easily. The complexity is in you, not in Tao. Tao is a very simple approach. More simple approach is not possible. No discipline, no character, no morality, nothing is expected of you. Only one thing, that you live naturally, simply, in tune with existence. And don't bring beliefs. And don't bring any theories, don't bring any theologies. Tao mystics never talk about God, reincarnation, heaven, hell. No, they don't talk about these things. These are all creations of human mind. Explanations for something which can never be explained. Explanations for the mystery. In fact, all explanations are against God, because explanation demystifies existence. Existence is a mystery, and one should accept it as a mystery, and should not pretend to know, should not pretend to have any explanation. No, explanation is not needed, only exclamation, a wondering heart. Awakened, surprised, feeling the mystery of life each moment, then and only then you know what truth is, and truth liberates. The fourth question, who is a Christian? Difficult to say because I am not a Christian. Neither Christ is a Christian. One thing is certain, that Christ is not Christian. Buddha is not Buddhist. Krishna is not Hindu. To be a Christian, one has to avoid to be a Christ. To be a Christian means to remain asleep. You are using a certain drug called Christianity to remain asleep. Somebody else is using another drug called Hinduism to remain asleep. But these are all drugs. A real man, a man of courage, has the courage to face reality as it is. A real man has the courage not to be second-hand. A Christian is second-hand. Christ is first-hand. Don't become second-hand. Go to reality, direct, immediate. Do not throw any belief system. Otherwise, you will never reach to reality. The belief system will hinder you. It will not allow you. It is an imprisonment. So there are many prisons on the earth. They say there are 300 religions. So 300 prisons, beautiful prisons, very well decorated, comfortable, convenient. But a prison is a prison. Get out of prisons. When I initiate you into sannyas, I am initiating you into freedom. My initiation into sannyas is initiation into absolute freedom. By becoming a sannyasin, you can become a Christ but never a Christian. You can become a Krishna but never a Hindu. You can become Buddha but never a Buddhist. And remember, if you really want to become a Buddha, then avoid the doctrine that has gathered around Buddha. The Zen people say, if you meet Buddha on the way, kill him immediately. They go even to this extent, they say, if you repeat the name of Buddha, immediately rinse your mouth. Not that they are disrespectful about Buddha. They have tremendous respect. Their respect is impeccable. But still, what they are saying is significant. It is very easy for the mind to gather knowledge, to gather belief. It is very easy for the mind because nothing is at stake. If you become a Christian, you don't put anything at stake. You are not committed to anything. You can simply go to the church. I have heard a definition of the Christian. A Christian is a man who feels repentance on a Sunday for what he did on Saturday and is going to do on Monday. Deceptions, all deceptions. The fifth question, when does discipline become meditation? Never. Discipline never becomes meditation. Meditation certainly becomes discipline. Don't start by discipline. Otherwise you will never arrive to meditation. Start by meditation and you will arrive to a discipline. And that discipline will not be imposed from the outside. It will be an inner overflow. You will become luminous from within. In fact, to call it discipline is not good. because it is so utterly free. But still, you can call it discipline. Your life will be disciplined, but not by any effort, but by your inner understanding. You will behave responsibly because you have, not that you have to behave that way. You will behave responsibly because a conscious man can behave only in that way. There is no other way. You will not behave for any profit, for any motive. You will behave out of your spontaneity. There will be no greed in it. If somebody is a Christian saint, he is greedy. He wants to reach to the Christian paradise. If somebody is a Jaina monk, he is greedy. He is a businessman. He is trying by virtue to win over, to be victorious in the other world, to become a conqueror, a spiritual conqueror. But the idea is of greed. If you go and look around the world, monks and saints and mahatmas, you will find 99% out of them are just greedy people, materialist people. They are disciplining themselves because they know if they sacrifice, great is going to be the payoff. They are ready to sacrifice. They are ready to even kill themselves. But it is a bargain. A man of meditation, understanding, has no motive, no bargain with reality. How can you bargain with reality? The whole idea is silly. A man of meditation is good because he feels good to be good. There is no motive. He is virtuous. Because to be virtuous, he feels so happy and so delighted. He loves, he shares, just like a flower shares its scent, its fragrance, natural. His virtue is not cultivated, conditioned. It is a growth in his being. So, you ask, when does discipline become meditation? Never. Discipline never becomes meditation, but meditation always brings a discipline, an inner discipline. And that discipline is beautiful. Because it is not against freedom, that discipline is because of freedom. That discipline is not a new cage. That discipline makes you totally free and liberated. You don't have any commandments to follow. You don't follow anybody, any scripture. You simply follow your own inner course. And there is no conflict within you. There are no alternatives. You are not to choose. You don't have to choose to do this or to do that. Whatsoever arises in your being, you do it. There is never any repentance, because a man of meditation cannot do wrong. It doesn't happen. Whatsoever he is doing totally. Next moment, he has moved beyond it, he never looks back. He never repents. Whatsoever happened, happens. Whatsoever did not happen, did not happen. He neither praises himself that I did this, neither he feels ever guilty that why I could not do this. He has no hangover. He is clean cut from the past. Each moment he moves into the future. Each moment the past disappears and he is fresh, like the dew drops in the morning. That discipline has freshness. That discipline has freedom. That discipline has fragrance. Otherwise, discipline makes people dull, stupid. Discipline makes people mediocre. Discipline kills your freedom, kills your being. Discipline becomes a suicide. So never start by discipline, start by meditation. That's why my emphasis is on meditation. If out of meditation discipline comes, good. Otherwise, it is not needed. It is better to have no character than to have a forced character. The sixth question, why am I still not happy? Because you still are, and because you are still chasing happiness. Happiness cannot be sought. You cannot seek it. It is a byproduct. It is a natural consequence. If you make a goal out of happiness, you will never find it. You will always miss it. It comes very silently. It comes like a whisper. It comes like your shadow. When you are totally absorbed into something and not at all thinking about happiness, it is there. Whenever you are thinking about it, it is not there. It is very shy. Whenever you look around, it disappears. Whenever you start thinking, am I happy or not? You are not. A happy man never thinks about happiness. He is so happy. How he can think about happiness? Only an unhappy man thinks about happiness. And by thinking, he becomes more unhappy. I have heard a big dog saw a little dog chasing its tail and asked, why are you chasing your tail so? Said the puppy, I have mastered philosophy. I have solved the problems of the universe, which no dog before me has rightly solved. I have learned that the best thing for a dog is happiness, and that happiness is in my tail. Therefore, I am chasing it, and when I catch it, I shall have it. Said the old dog, my son, I too have paid attention to the problems of this universe in my weak way and have formed some opinions. I too have judged that happiness is a fine thing for a dog and that happiness is in my tail, but I have noticed that when I go about my business, it comes after me. I need not chase it. Listen to this old dog's idea. You must have seen, whenever a dog is happy, he waves its tail. So naturally, dogs think happiness must be in the tail. Then they start chasing. But you cannot chase your own tail. You jump, the tail jumps. You jump more, the tail jumps more. You will get crazy. That's what is happening. The question is from Arup. Listen to the old dog. You go on your business and it comes after you. One thing has to be learned. Nothing is more valuable than that. And that is, be absorbed into whatsoever you are doing. Don't think whether it is a very great thing or not. If you are cleaning the floor, get totally absorbed into it. If you are cooking, get absorbed into it. Washing your clothes, get absorbed into it. Whenever you are dissolved into your acts, ego disappears. Then there is no space for the ego to exist. In that very moment when ego is not, there is happiness. So let me say it in this way. Ego is misery, no ego is happiness. And ego remains only when you are split. Ego is not whenever you are harmonious. Dancing, you become the dance, ego disappears. Singing, you become the song, ego disappears. Sitting silently, doing nothing, you become that non-doing, and ego disappears. Act or no act, remember one thing, get absorbed into it, whatsoever it is. You have gone for a morning walk, get totally absorbed into it. Forget all about yourself. Forget all about happiness. Forget all about health, the oxygen in the air, and all calculations. Forget all about that you have read about the beautiful experience of the morning walk. Forget everything. Just walk. And one day you will find, suddenly, you are totally there, and it has been there. Happiness has visited you. You will lose contact again and again. Because the moment you will start thinking about it, it is there, it is gone. You come in, it goes out. You go out, it comes in. You cannot be with it together. Arup and happiness, both, cannot be together in the room. That's impossible. You start losing yourself. You must be too much after it. You must be thinking continuously about it. You must be planning how to attain to it. Then it is never going to happen. If you are too much after happiness, all that happens is hell. If you forget about it, it is a very natural phenomenon. The self-consciousness does not allow it. It makes you very narrow. When the self disappears, self-consciousness disappears, you are vast like the sky. Suddenly, it pours into you. So the art of being happy is the art of forgetfulness. And when I am saying this, remember, now don't start planning about it, that how to forget, how not to think about happiness. Otherwise, again you are in the same trap. It is not a question of how. You simply do it. And it is not a question of tomorrow. You do it right now, this very moment. Listen to me, Arup. This very moment, you listen totally. Don't think what I am saying. Don't try to figure it out. Don't plan. Just listen. Just be here with me, this moment. And happiness is there. Silent, listening, attentive, with no self. How you can miss happiness? Nobody has ever heard that anybody can miss happiness when one is silent, attentive, self-forgetful, absorbed. If you cannot be absorbed into my word into my presence, it will be difficult for you to absorb anywhere else. Listening to me, just listen. And let it be this very moment. An old rabbi used to say to his people, repent the day before you die. But they said to him, Rabbi, we know not the day of our death. Then he answered, repent today, repent now. Don't postpone, because one never knows. Tomorrow you may not be here. The next moment you may not be here. So this is the only moment you have. Now is the only time you have, and here is the only place you have. I am not telling you to prepare, to get ready. That's the whole message of Tao too. You are ready as you are. You start enjoying this moment, and happiness will follow you. It always follows you, because it is in the tail. When you go doing your business, the tail comes. The sixth question. For the last 2-3 days, I feel as if you are constantly looking at me. Tell me, Bhagwan, what do you want to say to me through your eyes? I have been constantly looking at you, not only for 2-3 days. But you may have become aware only for 2-3 days. Good that you became aware. When I look at you, there is a message. Because there are many things which cannot be said by words. And I have to say with my hands. And I have to say with my eyes. And I have to say with my silence. And I have to say with my presence. Words are inadequate. They go only so far. Beyond that, they cannot go. But eyes can convey. The eye contact can become a great communion. So when you see me looking at you in your eyes, don't miss that moment. In that moment, don't start thinking. In that moment, just look into me. In that moment, be lost. In that moment, don't think, what is the message? Because if you start thinking about the message, you have missed. The eye contact itself is the message. You just be there, present, looking into my eyes, and something is going to happen. Something will transpire between me and you. Here I am not. If you can look into my eyes for a single second, totally, you will also disappear. And when the master and the disciple both are not, there is the meeting. I am newly initiated and wish to be instructed in Zen. Thus Kayosei approached the master Gensa. How do I enter in the way, master? Do you hear the river running nearby? Asked Gensa. Yes, said the seeker, I do, master. Then for a single moment there was absolute silence, and then Gensa said, there, here is the way to enter. He is not talking about the river, remember. When he said, do you hear the river running nearby? And the disciple became aware. That awareness, for a single moment, thoughts stopped. He heard the river running by. The noise, the song, the dance of the river. For a single moment, he was no more self-conscious. His awareness was total. The master watched. When the master felt, the moment has come. The seeker is no more there. The questioner is no more there. The self-consciousness has disappeared. There is only awareness, silent listening, and the river running by. He shouted, "There! Here is the way to enter." Remember, he is not talking about the river. He is talking about this inner awareness, this silence, this self-unconsciousness, this purity, this innocence that has entered into the being of this disciple. He says, "Here is the way to enter. When I look into your eyes, and if you are also looking into my eyes, there, here is the way to enter." The seventh question: I often take drugs. Once when I was attending the discourse, I closed my eyes and suddenly felt the same as I feel on a drug trip. Bhagavan, is there any relationship or similarity between samadhi and drugs? There is and there is not. There is, because drugs create a false samadhi, a pseudo samadhi, almost like the samadhi. So there is a relationship. Even if drugs create false samadhi, they create something similar to samadhi. And there is no relationship also, because the false is not the real, and the false can never be the real. It is like this. If you are hungry in the night and you dream that you are eating. Yeah. Eating in the dream, everything looks like eating. You feel satisfied, you turn over and go to sleep. In the morning you feel it was just a dream. It has not nourished you. It simply deceived you. Drugs deceive you and create a false samadhi. They don't nourish you. Someday when you will awake, then you will see that you were simply dreaming that you are eating. It helps, because if you are hungry in your sleep, the dream that you are eating helps you to continue sleep. Otherwise your sleep will be broken. If hunger is too much, how can you sleep? So the mind creates a dream. The mind says, "Okay, you are hungry, eat." In the dream you go to the fridge, you open the fridge, you are eating many things that you have always been denying yourself. You eat well, you feel perfectly good, you turn over and you go to sleep. In the morning you know that it was a false food. A dream food cannot help. But you will know only in the morning, not before it. And the morning I am talking about may not come if you don't work for it. So drugs can deceive you, and they can deceive you for your whole life. They create a similarity through chemical change, through chemical coercion on the body and the mind cells. A certain state is created which feels as if one has arrived. In the morning, when the drug influence is over, you are exactly in the same place as you have been before, maybe even lower.
Because every high experience through drug is bound to be followed by a very low and depressed experience. Then again more drugs are needed and the quantity has to be increased. You become an addict. This is not a way towards truth because it is not nourishing. Samadhi is a nourishment. You are not drugged by samadhi. You are awakened. But there is a similarity. So sometimes it can happen. If you have been taking drug, listening to me, there can come a moment when you become silent. You become enwrapped with me. And suddenly there is a moment of tremendous joy and beauty. And because you have been taking the drug, you will start thinking in terms of the drug. But if it is happening just by listening to me, think of it. If you meditate, if you go into the same world where I exist, into the same dimension where I exist, just by listening to me, if it can happen, then what to say about when you yourself will move into that world? Then you will know. Then you will have something to compare. Then you will know all those experiences through drugs were just foolish, silly. You were wasting your energy and wasting your time. But they keep you asleep. If you are interested in sleep, drugs are good. Alcohol is good. Any type of chemical that helps you feel that you are happy. Happiness never comes through it, but just gives you the illusion of being happy. It's good, it keeps you asleep. But if you are interested in becoming alert, awakened, then it is dangerous. Then you are undoing your very longing of becoming awakened, enlightened. You are undoing it by your drugs. I have heard a traveling salesman in the deep south hit one hotel where the rooms were infested with giant economy-sized mosquitoes. Furthermore, he was told that no mosquito netting was available. All you got to do is follow the example of the man who owns this hotel, Colonel Rip Clutterbaum, the desk clerk told him. And how, inquired the salesman sarcastically, does your blasted Colonel Clutterbaum manage to go to sleep without a net? He does not, admitted the clerk. But the Colonel is what you might call a dedicated drinker. He goes to bed so well oiled, he does not notice the mosquitoes for the first half of the night. And for the second half, the mosquitoes are so drunk, they don't notice the Colonel. This way you can go and play. But you are wasting a tremendous opportunity. Avoid drugs. If you are really interested, then why not take the real drug? Samadhi is the real drug. But you cannot purchase it at the druggist. You cannot purchase it through a dope pusher. Samadhi you have to attain through great intensity, thirst, passion, inquiry. Samadhi you have to attain. Drugs are available from the outside. Samadhi happens in your innermost core. It is the ultimate drug, soma. The last question. Bhagwan, I want to ask three very short questions. Thank you. If you ask short questions, I am going to give you short answers. First, what do you think of life? Life is wonderful. Without it, you are dead. The second, what do you think about the love of a good woman? Now that is not fair. To ask such a question to a chronic bachelor is not right. But if you have asked, I have to answer. And I know the answer. This is the answer. There is nothing better in the world than the love of a good woman. Unless, of course, it is the love of a bad woman. And the third, was there any long period in your life when you did not speak at all? Believe it or not, but once it did happen, that for a year and a half, I didn't speak at all. No morning discourse, no evening darshan. That 1.5 a year was the time immediately after I was born. Enough for today.